And around 5 o'clock is when Noble Silence began. And Noble Silence is not just silence verbally, but it's silence across the board. No gestures, no handshakes, no smiling, no eye contact. Basically, everything locked down. And at that point, we all took an oath. The oath was to abstain from a number of things, abstain from speaking and communication with the outside world, the inside world, abstain from reading, abstain from writing. Like, what am I getting myself into?
Join me weekly as we unlock strategies to elevate every aspect of your life through the power of mindset. If you enjoy the show, subscribe so that you never miss an episode. Hey, everyone. This is Jack Trauma. And boy, do I have a treat for you. We all live in a world of constant noise, notifications, conversations, the endless scroll of social media. But what happens when all of that just stops? Today's guest, and due to his deeply personal experience, we're going to refer to him as Mr. X. He recently returned from a journey that most of us can barely imagine. 10 days of complete silence, no phones, no communication, no contact with family, no distractions, just silence and meditation day after day. And when Mr. X first told me about this retreat, I thought back to my own experience with an 8-hour silent meditation, which felt like a lifetime, though a beautiful one. 10 full days? That's a depth of experience that's hard to fathom. And today, we're going to explore what pushes someone to step away from everything and what surfaces when every distraction is stripped away. And that raw experience of facing yourself in silence day after day. Mr. X, I am so thrilled that you're here, man. Welcome to the show.
Thanks so much. I appreciate the invite and being able to be a guest on your show and also at the same time share some of my experience.
Oh man, it's going to be a great conversation here. So, Mr. X, let's go back. So, what made you decide to disconnect from everything for 10 days of meditation?
So I have to take you back just a little step before it, and I will give you a little summary excerpt of who I am as a person. I came across a word 5 or so years ago from a gentleman named Jesse Itzler, entrepreneur, public speaker. It was called a misogi. And a misogi is a Japanese term that is used to really just cleanse, and it's done annually. And if you fast forward that tradition, which dates back hundreds of years, the misogi today in the traditional term is to do something hard and challenging once a year that would define the next 364 days or 65 days, I guess. And it would leave such a lasting impact on you in a positive way. And there was a chance, 50-50, that you would actually pull through with it. You would actually commit to it, you would do it, and actually complete it. And in those last 5 years, I took a liking to the misogi, and I've actually done many challenges, but along the way, all those challenges were always physical. And then about a year and a half ago, one of my nephew's best friend, young man, young 20s, told me about a Vipassana meditation retreat. And in 2023, after listening to him, what he described, I said, that's right up my alley. That's hard. That's challenging. However, different than anything I've done in the past, this would be all about, I thought at the time, very mental, less physical. And as we'll discuss, it turned out to be a little bit of both.
Interesting. Wow. I love hearing these journeys, the start of what makes these decisions in our lives. That's amazing to me. Now, I want you to, because I am dying to know, set the scene for us. What happens when you first arrive in your mind, in your heart, in your soul? What do you feel? What do you witness? What do you see?
So I was, I definitely went in with very clear, a clear mind that I would have no expectations of what I was doing. I did not know much about what I was doing. So in general, that would normally bring you a sense of nervousness. And I've learned in my life to take as best I can the word nervous and change it into excitement. So that excitement for me was to really have something that I've had for quite a long time, which is a beginner's mind and a mindset that would allow me to fully surrender myself to the experience. So when I arrived at that moment, you can tell just like I'm an athlete, just like an athlete, you got your game time butterflies and you're seeing people that you don't know. You're surrendering yourself to a place that you've never been before that feels sterile and quiet. And at that moment, you're making a decision when you walk across that door, you're either going to really fully commit yourself to something that you're doing, or you're not sure. And that oftentimes leads to not a successful endeavor. So I was really trying to remain excited and open-minded and curious. But at the same time, there is no doubt I'm a human being. There was definitely a sense of nervousness, basically getting myself in this building and sort of proverbially locking the doors.
Yeah, I was gonna ask you, you know, from an emotional perspective, aside from the butterflies and the unknowns, new people, new environment, did you have this rush of emotions come over you that was one of excitement, fear, joy, and everything else that comes into that mix? How would you describe that?
Yeah, I think because of who I am in my life, I've always enjoyed feeling uncomfortable and being uncomfortable in settings like that. And surrender's become a big word for me. And oftentimes people look at that as a negative term. And I've really become to really embrace the word surrender. And surrendering to me allows that emotional state that I'm living with to be more accepting of what I'm doing, to really surrender myself to the environment and really to the best I'm able to, those emotions are there. I'm not going to talk to my family for 10 days. How's the business that I'm attached to going to do? Are they going to need me? You're so egotistical thinking, how's it going to be? I've gone on vacations before and I've never been detached. You know, you knew that you had the phone to call me if you needed me, or from a family, a friend, or a business perspective. And so emotionally, this was the first time I've ever done this, and most people, you know, don't. And I was pretty much all over the place. It was a rush of emotions, of a little bit of fear, but again, feeling like, well, if I surrender to this, it's going to be okay. And missing out on things, there's no doubt about it. Feel like you're missing out on things and not being there for other people. So there was definitely a piece of that as well. It was a cloud of emotions, no doubt.
Oh, I bet it was. No matter how you think you prepare for something like this, if you've never done it, and you know what's happening in the next 10 days, like you just described, I could imagine all the rush of emotions that showered over you. Can you, because I love to paint a picture for me and for our audience, can you describe the atmosphere? Before we start diving into a lot of the meat and potatoes of what you experienced, tell me a little bit about the atmosphere. As you pulled in, what did you see? When you walked in, what did you see? What was that like?
So I pulled up. It's a little bit off the main highway, so it was really quiet and serene, which I think you'd want in a place like this. Wooded area. The building looked like any kind of dormitory type place, single floor, not two, but kind of dormitory space in there that, you know, it was only going to be decorated because you decorated it. There was no decorating going on. There were volunteers there to greet you and make you feel warm and comfortable and welcoming. And really at that point, when you stepped through the door and you dropped your bags, and I'll get to that if we get to that point, physically and proverbially, like dropped your bags, you are now registering with some folks there that, again, were volunteering their time and really getting yourself settled in. But there was somebody at any moment that can answer questions and make you feel a little bit more comfortable. But you know, not to paint it as an awful place, although there were moments that I felt awful, it felt very sterile, but at the same time, super professional and super organized. And for a not-for-profit, and we can get into some of that, it felt like any business that I had been attached to or run or watched along the way, it felt like a well-oiled machine. It was not helter-skelter. It was dialed in. And let's face it, this facility alone has been open since 1982. This wasn't their first showing. I can't imagine how many countless people went in there. And then to the people that you saw, the non-welcoming volunteers, you definitely felt some sense through their facial expressions and even hearing some in their voice, because we did speak before we started that silence portion, a little trepidation, a little bit nervousness, the same feelings I had going in there.
Interesting. I would think, having never been to a facility like that, there would be some type of this feeling of it being somewhat sterile. But the fact that it is a nonprofit and it's super run professionally speaks volumes for their passion behind the profound effects that this experience has on people that visit there. Would you agree?
Absolutely. No doubt about it. I can't imagine how much fine tuning has been done over time. We were fortunate enough that when we broke silence on the 10th day, that the gentleman that helped put this building up with the teacher, as he's known, back in 1982, he painted a picture for us without showing us pictures of this facility and what it looked like. And I think it started off with 4 acres, and today it's 100 plus acres, or it's 80 acres. And in that time, they've developed this facility into what I would consider to be a world-class type place. Trust me, there's nothing luxurious about it. I'm not trying to say world-class, but at that level of what you would expect from a place like this, it was as world-class as you'd expect a place like that to be. And that made things very comfortable in a very uncomfortable situation.
Yeah. Oh, of course. No, that's really, really helpful. Yeah, because if it wasn't well-run, or if you were getting, you know, feedback from the staff that wasn't really welcoming, or, you know, it could have completely, you're there for mindset. That would have reversed everything.
No doubt about it. Very okay. much so.
All right. So you're there. You've submitted to the fact that you're there. You're all in. You've surrendered anything that's outside of your normal life, outside of those four walls. And so the reality now is, okay, I'm ready to do this. So two questions. Walk us through what a typical day looked like. And then what would you say was the biggest shock, if there was one for you, over the first 24 hours to your body, to your mind, or anything that you could get to for the first day? Now, maybe this happened down the road. What are your thoughts around that?
Okay, so let me give you the typical day. So after we were given instruction on Wednesday afternoon around 5 o'clock is when Noble Silence began. And Noble Silence is not just silence verbally, but it's silence across the board. No gestures, no handshakes, no smiling, no eye contact, basically everything locked down. And at that point, we all took an oath. The oath was to abstain from a number of things, abstain from speaking and communication and with the outside world, the inside world, abstain from reading, abstain from writing. You know, I'm a journaler. In the last 4 months, I've picked up journaling and I've truly appreciated it and what it means to me. And to stop that and not be able to do it was obviously a change. Killing, and we'll get back to that one maybe in a second also. You know, like, what am I getting myself into? You just told me there's no killing for the next 10 days. But I could explain more what that means. So once we were done with that oath, the next 24 hours in a typical day in the life of somebody that was there would be 4 a.m. the bell, and legitimate bell would be gonged outside your room. Wake up. You got about a half an hour to get yourself acclimated and ready to go. And at 4:30 to 6:30, I was meditating. You had options at that point several times during the day to meditate in your own room, which was probably about 9 feet by 12. I think I measured it one day because I was so bored.
Mr. X, if I may just interject, I have just a point of clarification for the listeners. 4:30 a.m. to 6:30 a.m. was the first window of meditation, right?
That is correct.
Okay, continue, please.
Yeah, absolutely. So that 4:30 to 6:30, and I'll repeat this word a couple of times, was sort of like a solo, your choice meditation. You could meditate in your own room, or you can go to the meditation hall where there were 50 women and 50 gentlemen that were in there separated in that meditation hall. You could meditate in there. So during that 4:30 to 6:30, you had a choice where you wanted to meditate. Was it straight through the 2 hours? No. Did I take a break after an hour and 15 minutes on average? Yes. Walked around, stretched a little bit, and then got back after it again. From 6:30 to 8 o'clock, you had breakfast. 6:30 to 7, you were eating. 7 to 8 o'clock, you were sort of just, you know, you were able to go outside, take a walk on the trail. You'd see other meditators out there, but absolutely no contact, no eye contact. You're pretty much walking with your head down unless there was no one around to be able to look up at the sky and the trees and the birds. And then at 8 o'clock, you did your first session of what they call group meditation. And from 8 till 9 in 1 hour, all 100 people were in the meditation room with the teachers. Very little talking, a little bit of instruction maybe at the beginning, but it was an hour of complete silence, an hour of complete no movement, sitting in your posture and doing that day's activities. So that was 8 to 9. 9 o'clock to 11 o'clock was again back to solo or your preference where you want to meditate. 11 to 11:30 was your next meal, which was considered lunch. And from 11 to 11:30 you ate. And then you again had until about 1 o'clock, or not until, you had until 1 o'clock for time. Go outside, take a walk. I took a nap every single day. I felt that was a good part of my routine. So I took about a 20-minute nap every single day. And then at 1 o'clock, it was back to your own solo mode meditation where you wanted to do that from 1 to 2:30. 2:30 to 3:30 was group meditation, second one of the day, all hands on deck in the meditation hall. And then 3:30 to 5 o'clock was back to solo meditation again with a little of instruction. 5 to 5:30, as a new student, which I was allowed a piece of fruit, a banana, apple, or orange, and some tea. Old students were allowed nothing. Your last meal was at 11:30 in the morning. That was it for the rest of the day. And I don't even know if I consider a piece of fruit to be a lot of food at 5 o'clock, but that's what I got. And then 6 o'clock to 9 o'clock was one more group meditation, a discourse where the teacher was giving full, really in-depth instruction of what Vipassana was all about and what you were experiencing there. And then finally, you would do one more half meditation for a half an hour between 8:30 and 9. And then 9 o'clock, that was it. Get to bed. And my head was on the pillow every night by 9:12. And back up at 4 the next day to do it again.
Wow. Wow. That's
that was about 9. By the way, that's 9. That's approximately, if you stuck to the plan, it was about 9 hours of meditation a day.
9 hours in total.
Yeah. On average, 9.
Were you walking the grounds at all during that 24-hour period?
Fortunately for us, like the Northeast, it hasn't been very rainy. So we had a great week, and it allowed me, and I'm an outdoors person. I love being outdoors. So any moment I had a chance, even if it was for 5 minutes, I'd step outside the door close to my residence, my dorm. I'd step outside just to get some fresh air, that cold, good, fresh air. But twice a day, I took about a 15-minute walk during the morning breakfast time. I had time for that. And then during the lunch, I took about a 30 to 35-minute walk. And they have a nice trail. Like I said, it's 80 acres, I think, now. So they have about a quarter mile of, my guess, a quarter mile or so trail that you're able to meander through different ways. So getting outside was really important to me. And I think it was helpful.
So in that first 24 hours, what were some of the things that you were processing in your mind? What were you thinking about during that first day that you were there?
So I think early on in that first 24, if I can get back to that, I had decided for myself, there was never a question I wasn't going to do this all the way through to the finish line. And there is a group of people that do typically bow out. Fortunately for my group of 50 gentlemen, I can't tell you the women because I wasn't part of that. No one bowed out, which was absolutely amazing. And it was a great, I absolutely appreciated that we all stuck through it. And you watched human emotion and human interaction, you know, not interaction, obviously, but you were able to see looks on people's faces. But during that first 24 hours, I think I was really just sizing up the situation and setting a game plan for myself. I think what I realized that at that moment was, while some of those other activities I mentioned to you that I've enjoyed doing over the last 5-10 years, I've trained for and I prepared for, I've only meditated for 20 minutes at a shot, straight up, high posture, feet crossed, hands on my lap. I've only ever done that for 20 minutes. And now I was being asked to do that for 9 hours, 9 or 10 times a day. So at that point, I started my preparation. And I'm a big Navy SEAL guy, and not that I was in the SEALs or the teams, but I read up on it quite a bit. And one of the terms that they like to use there is plan the dive and dive the plan. And I'm a big plan the dive and dive the plan guy. So I plan the dive and then I go and take the dive. And obviously they mean underwater. So at that point, that first 24 hours, I'm really just trying to size up what my life is going to be for the next 10 days, where I'm going to put routine into place, how I could put routine into place, which is an important piece for me in my life because that's a comforting thing. And I'm also kind of sizing up how am I going to be able to manage this? Not only from a mindful perspective, but also from a pain management perspective. Because even though I thought this was 90% about mental, this was pretty close to 50-50. We were not meditating laying down on the floor in the meditation hall. And I quickly realized that my back was not prepared and other parts of my body was not prepared to do that. So I think that first 24 of that shock was dealing with that. One of the things that somebody would have asked me would have been, well, how are you already managing the non-talking and not being connected? I definitely carried bags in with me. I definitely had to pull my mind back to the act in which I was doing, the exercise I was doing, without thinking about the baggage of the past or what happens 10 days after I get out of here. I'm normal. That's what would happen. But really, I was not as concerned about not being able to talk to people. I was not concerned about the noble silence of not being able to interact with people. I'm a stillness guy. And I allowed stillness to be acceptable for me and instead get right to the tactics I was going to use and the routines I was going to use to try to move through this.
Wow. Wow, that's pretty wild. And, you know, of course, to the listeners of the show, I happen to know Mr. X, and everything that he just described is exactly right. He's an outdoorsman. He prepares before he does anything. He's very methodical in his approach. So it goes to show that took place in his preparation before he got there. And then while he's there, he's thinking about, okay, here's the layout of the land, and here's how I'm going to navigate through it. And that probably just gave you a good runway to follow through that 10 days. Now, I would assume that while all of that is in place, that there were some hard moments for you during this 10-day experience. And maybe those were emotional. Maybe they were physical, as you just alluded to. I know for me, if I'm sitting on a hard surface for hours,
we did have
and
cushions.
Hours, with a cushion or without a
cushion? Oh, yeah, we had cushions, and there were fortresses of cushions by the time you were done. And it was really such a behavioral, even though it wasn't, you weren't able to have, eye contact and stuff. When you walk in a room, you notice people sitting there. You're not obviously having eye contact, but over the period of time, you watched 50 or so people, or at least the people close to you in a dark room or a darkened room. You watch them try to fall into regularity with their cushions. And before you know it, you had almost like cushion fortresses, like where people are surrounded, cushion under their leg, cushion under their butt, and different things. And it took me about 4 or 5 days to fall into my own comfort space where I knew the position I was going to be in. I'm sorry to take you off track there, but
this is all about you, and I love this because I know for me, I just began with a personal trainer, and he was looking at some of the weak spots of my body, and based on my movements and how my mobility was, and we all have core related strength issues. Sometimes, if we're sitting down on a hardened surface and we cross our legs, some of us are so tight from sitting and not stretching in the proper way. So to me, if I'm in that room, I know where my weaknesses lie. And I know that just sitting there and trying to become mindful, but yet my focus is on my body and how uncomfortable it is. Did you kind of grapple with that a little bit?
No doubt about it. But not to advance the story and allow you to take the folks that are listening in through it. But the interesting part is, and as this all started to become uncovered to me, because I was not fully aware of what I was doing, that pain management, that idea of knowing that I was going to be uncomfortable and I was going to experience pains in different parts of my body, was actually so significantly part of the process of Vipassana meditation. And I can tell you all that are listening from an intellectual level what that all means. But just like someone tried to describe somebody that just ran the New York City Marathon and here's what it was like, the person on the other side listening in will not really truly understand what that person means unless they actually experience it themselves. So yeah. I'm happy, and I'd love to get into some of that. But it's interesting because early on, at the beginning of this, I looked at pain as pain. And I tried to navigate through pain. But as the process went on of learning Vipassana, it became less about the way I originally started looking at pain and more of using pain to help me through the pathway of what they were trying to teach us and educate us. And that became fascinating to me.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Oh yeah, they're all interlinked. It's all part of the entire process. That's fascinating. So with that, because you're giving us some breakthroughs, and I want to talk more about some of the breakthroughs, some of the realizations that you've had through this process. Maybe some beliefs that you've had coming into that experience that you realize are not serving you well, or may not be any value to you as you move through. So can you share with us anything that comes to mind? Maybe it's a day four, a day six, or tell us what your thoughts are around breakthroughs and realizations.
Yeah. I'll actually try to pull a couple of things together to sort of paint the picture, but I'm going to start by simply saying anything I try to verbalize to you all is just from this guy's perspective. It's an opinion. It's a layman in this practice. Even though 10 days seems not like the beginners, when I first looked it up, I said, I'll take the 3-day introductory class. They're like, no. It's 10 days. That's it. This is the introductory. You can't do anything less than that. And that became very apparent to me during the process, which I'll explain. But my point about it is anything I verbally tell you, anybody that's interested, look up Vipassana, V-I-P-A-S-S-A-N-A, and learn more about it, because I think you'll stand that if you are curious, like I was, to learn more about it and how it can help you in your own life. Maybe you're not able to do 10 days. Maybe you just don't think you can. But I do think there's an intellectual portion of it that would help somebody living a more peaceful life, a more harmonious life. So with that being said, look it up, but I'll give you this guy's perspective. It's funny, as I was walking around the facility one morning, it must have been like the 7th, 8th day. What I realized was, to a certain extent, I felt like I was living a little bit of the Karate Kid movie. And I think this will be a fun anecdote for this conversation. I don't remember it specifically, but I know it had something to do with the fact that Daniel was his name, shows up, and Mr. Miyagi says, you're no talking. You're now surrendering to me here in what we're doing. And then for the next X amount of minutes of the movie, Daniel's doing everything from washing this guy's car to, painting the fence to cleaning the deck. And he's starting thinking, what are we doing here? Why are we doing this? And then finally he has enough and says, could you tell me why we're doing this? I'm not getting it. You have this beautiful house now and I've got nothing in return. I thought I was coming here to learn the art of karate. And then finally, Mr. Miyagi opens up the door by actually saying to him, paint the fence or whatever it is, as he's throwing punches at him. And it obviously makes a huge impact on him to say, now I understand, teacher. Now I understand, teacher. I had such a very similar anecdotal experience of what I went through. The first 3 days of being there are about really clearing your mind and really taking control of the fact, or not taking control, but clearing your mind of everything that had existed in that was dragging you backwards. And that 3 days of meditation was nothing but focusing in, really, just to give the folks listening here a visual of nothing but your nostrils to the top of your lips. Okay, so that little triangular space, there was nothing but 3 days of paying attention to that space. And the purpose of that was really just to not only clear your mind, but also allow you to narrow in the focus. I equated it to, and I think most people do, that I went to the gym for my mind. So instead of going to an LA Fitness or some gym and lifting weights and trying to build muscle, I was trying to build muscle around my mind. So the way they did it as part of the practice was to zone in on that little space on your body, 4% of your body, 3%, whatever it is, and focus in on there. And as the process goes on, you're thinking a day or two, like, how many more moments do I need to do this? How many more hours do I need to do this? And then you start moving along the pathway towards noticing senses, itches, the airflow into your nostrils, et cetera, during that period of time. And just being aware of those sensory, issues or itches and pain points you get. 4th day on is when I start realizing the Karate Kid moment. Now this starts becoming a little bit more apparent to me. We're going to take those pains that you and I talked about a little bit earlier. We're going to take those great sensations, and you do get them. I know it might be hard for people to believe sitting still for an hour like that with your eyes closed. But you will have little tingles in your body and sensations in your body of vibrations and stuff. But the purpose of the next 7 days, which is really Vipassana meditation, is to become, at a layman's term, aware of those sensations, the good, the bad, to not label them, to recognize what they are, and then through the law of impermanence, that everything starts and stops, everything arises and falls, birth and death, and everything in between, that those pains are going to come and go, those tingles are going to come and go, those itches are going to come and go, and don't do anything about them other than be aware of them, recognize them, and move through them. And through that act of doing that, that pain that I told you about in day 1, 2, 3, which was pain management, became more of a practice in me and realizing, and now comes the outward of this 10 days later, that in life we're going to feel pain. We're going to feel agony to the biggest extent, losing a loved one. And I'm not saying that you should just be stoic about it and pass through it as if you didn't care. But the practice of Vipassana meditation is to allow you to deal with those goods and bads, if I may so label them, in a way that's just a little bit more about seeing them the way they are and not the way you're judging them or interpreting them. What's painful to one person might not be as painful to you. It's a relative thing. So what I'm doing at that moment for those 7 days was trying to interpret my judgment of those pains as just a coming and going, a passing and an arising and a falling. So breakthroughs come via ultimately saying, I am not going to take that pain and sink it into me as an indexed item in my world. So now when it comes to the next pain, I'm going to resuscitate that index and say, I know what that pain feels like. I've been there before. It feels like pain. It's to sort of at the surface level, quench them a little bit and pull them down a little bit so they don't become indexed in my body. So therefore, I'm sort of starting to eradicate any kind of suffering or misery or cravings or aversions I might feel in my life then or even going forward. It was a lot there, but I hope I answered your question.
Oh, for sure. For sure. No, that is absolutely fascinating because you're a pretty aware person, both physically and mentally. So you came there with some awareness, but I would imagine that this process has taken that awareness to yet another level, both physically and mentally. Would you say that the change for you has been profound, or would you say it's marginal?
You know what's interesting? I've asked myself that question because I think the word profound is a very serious word to talk around, right? I, for the most part, and maybe it's through my activities or maybe it's through my life lessons of loss in life and so forth. And anyone that knows me knows my story, just like I know yours if I'm close enough to you. And I've done a pretty good job of quieting my mind and having a calm mind all along. So, you know, there were definitely people in there that were not with a calm mind. They were going through, and you could tell, and plus when we broke silence, we talked a little bit. Why are you here? What were you doing here? You know, and there were addictions. There were very challenging moments going on with their own family of watching people suffer, et cetera. And they surrendered themselves to do those things. I can't honestly tell you I went in there with something that I was trying to work out. Some people said to me before I went, I hope you find what you're looking for. And I said, what if I'm not looking for anything? And they said, well, what are you doing? I said, well, I'm looking for a good challenge and I'm also looking to be curious and learn. To answer your question, profound versus marginal, I'm a 1% better guy. If I can get 1% better, then that's enough for me. And if I have any unrealistic expectations, I'm going to become 20% better or 30, then it's probably not a real situation I'm dealing with.
Yeah.
To go all the way to the extreme or profound, being a realist about the situation, and I'm not here to promote it. I'm not here to advertise it. See me in 6 months. See me in a year. See me in 2 years. If I have become a better human being, if I'm more peaceful in my life, if I've passed on some of the wisdom I've learned from this experience to others that might not be able to do it, then I promise you, I will start using the word profound. But today, 3 or 4 days after being there, I can't yet say that. But did I learn? Absolutely. Did I become 1% better? No doubt about it. And am I excited to take those things with me into the future? That's what I'm about. I'm excited about that.
You're unstoppable, Mr. X. You really are. And so, and something just came to mind, and I, before we continue along this track, because I have other questions to ask you about this. So, of course, a big sacrifice you know, for you to get off the radar, like you said, your family, your work, they're going to function without you. They're going to have to. Everybody's going to have to function. But was it more of a challenge for your family that Mr. X wasn't home? Was it more of a challenge for your work, or did things just kind of go along as planned?
So after day three, when you clear your cobwebs of, that was an important meeting I had on Wednesday morning. Oh my gosh, how is that going to play out when I'm not around? It was something important I happened to be working on. You start to realize during this process, and trust me, you have I think it's 17 hours a day you're awake. So while you're meditating only for about 8, 9, 10 hours, I'd like to say that you're really meditating for 17. Because short of me taking that 120-minute nap during the day, I was walking and meditating. I was eating and meditating. I was doing anything and meditating. So 17 hours a day is a long time to be awake in your own thoughts and think about things. It took all 3 days to clear that stuff and say the following, at least for me, it's an own personal experience, that regardless of what was going on at the moment, you did the best you could up until that time. And you're hopeful that things play out in a positive, enforced, you know, good way. And that's it. And you got to clear your deck of that. And you got to feel like, well, I don't know what the result is going to be, but I can't impact the result, which again gets back to that whole entire thought process, you know, which is it's, and I'll give you a little Stoic philosophy, and I'm a big Stoicism guy. Their belief of it's not the things that upset us, it's our judgment on those things.
Mm-hmm.
And really that plays so much into Vipassana meditation. I can control what I can control. And it's how I respond to those things. So to answer your question of myself versus the other folks in my life, and I'll use the word deserting them for a little bit, I knew this was going to be hard on them too. And they might not want to admit it. They probably said they enjoyed the time away from me and the quiet from me, et cetera. But I knew that it was going to be profound on them potentially as well, and there was a chance. It could be all the way to the extreme of my family thinking, you know, is this what life would be like if Dad wasn't here or my husband wasn't here? You know, to maybe even a little bit anger, which I did get from one of my family members. I won't share which one, which was, you weren't there when I needed you. However, I knew I could get in touch with you if I really needed to. And that made me a little frustrated and a little anger. And I get it. Everyone experienced, and my experience was my experience. They had a completely different experience. But guess what? I came back. Everything was still standing. On a funny anecdotal note, I went in the day after the election. I literally found out minutes before I went into my meditation retreat at 4 o'clock, because I tend not to be a very news oriented guy, and I'm definitely not on social media. I found out minutes before by accident from my daughter who said something. But yeah, the next 10 days, I had no idea what was I going to do about it. I had no idea what I was coming out to. And so it was very interesting to kind of leave that baggage. I thought about my family. I thought about my team at my office. I wondered how they were doing. I wonder how they were navigating. But really, to really truly go through this process and take it all the way to the end, I knew I'd have to drop that at some point. And it didn't happen until day 3 or 4. And that's the reason why they set up those first 3 days to do that.
Yeah.
And yes, did I still think about things along the way? Yes. But the percentage of time that I was focusing on what diminished tremendously. Not because I didn't care, but because I kind of left that behind and got focused in on what I was doing. But it was tough.
Of course it was. And it's interesting how your reality was so focused on mindfulness and you were at peace while you were there. And of course, there were some uncomfortable moments. There's no question about that. But then the people that you love and love you, and then folks that rely on you, there's a feeling of loss on their end. So there's these different dynamics taking place outside of the safe space that you were in. And it's fascinating how we all, and that energy is transferred when people are not available and they're doing something to better themselves. I don't know to what extent you were thinking about all of that while you were there. Maybe on occasion you were, and then got right back into some meaningful things for yourself. Yeah.
Yeah. No doubt. I definitely focus in on it. You know, it's a lot of time by yourself. And it's a lot of, you know, time in your own head. And as much as you're trying to exercise that mind, that monkey mind, that puppy wandering mind, and that's what we were doing there, and create a better situation for yourself to manage it and deal with it, at the same exact time, you can't help. You wouldn't care. You wouldn't be human if you weren't, you know, reflecting back to, you know, how is so-and-so, whether it's family, friend, or somebody that might have been going through something or thinking something, like, how are they doing right now? And to be honest with you, I felt, you know, one could easily argue what I did was a very selfish act. And I respect that and I appreciate that. And I thought about that on several occasions. At the same time, I also appreciate how grateful I am that the people in my life allowed me to do this and recognize who I am as an individual and the practices and precepts that I live by to be able to say, it's going to be okay. Please go and do this. That would be great. I hope you learned something. Maybe you pass some things on to me, but I hope it helps you along in the path where you're going. So I'm super grateful for them that did that. But you definitely feel a little selfishness and really sort of the thing you're trying to get rid of is because it's about oneself. It's not about oneself. You're trying to get rid of the egotistical part of it while you're in there, that it's about me. Like, how are they going to survive? And can they answer that question? And what if my child needs me? But at the same time, you're trying to move away from that.
Right.
And think to it. And I'm going to give you a big word and jump in if you want more to know more about it. But craving and aversion lead to suffering and misery. And really, again, if anyone's interested, look it up, learn more about it. But I am a firm believer today that our cravings and the things we avert, we don't want somebody to pass away. We don't want to, you know, lose our job and those things. Those are what causes us suffering and misery. But yeah. The other big word, which was a big word for me, that was a huge word for them that I had no idea, which is, it's the word attachment. We feel attached. And when we feel really attached to things, that's a lot of times when suffering and misery arises within us.
Amen. Amen.
And man, is it tough to detach, and it is tough to not be attached to things, from your actual own family, to the house you live in, to the car you drive, to the watch you have. But It's the root goes right back. It's a deep root to those things. Attachment is real.
Yeah, it is real. It's real. It's real. And any disruption to that attachment, small or big, it could really cause somebody to feel this sense of loss and confusion. And oh, my world has been turned upside down. You used the word before, selfish. And I'll tell you, this is just my feeling on this. In no way do I believe that someone who decides to work on themselves and to experience something that's a little challenging, and through that process, they're able to become a better human being, a better husband or wife, a better parent, a better sibling, a better colleague at work. If we really look at this without an emotional attachment to the situation, I think that in the grand scheme of things, we are all very committed to our lifestyles. We're committed to our families. We're committed to our work. We're committed to everything. And to go off the radar for any number of days, to be alone and to reset, there is not, in my world, there is no selfishness in that at all. In fact, it's selfless. And that's how I view it.
Yep.
And I'm also very biased because my intention is to do something for myself, and it happens to be in Guatemala. And it's more of an emotional, physical experience where our chakras are a storage of unresolved emotions over the years. And as men particularly, and some women, but men have this uncanny way of functioning in life without expressing deep-seated, deep-rooted emotions that we have learned to bottle up and stuff in our body. Our body is a vessel, and we have these areas in our body where those emotions store up. And no wonder why we have times when we blow up, and we're triggered in such a way. And the gravity of the conversation didn't really warrant that kind of reaction, but because the emotions are at the surface, it pops up. And I mean, look what's going on the global stage with all the wars. I mean, these are emotionally driven, very passionate decisions that are being made. So I'm all for it. And there's so many different modalities out there that people can do to get themselves one with themselves again.
By the way, first of all, I absolutely love that. And I'm tiny bit familiar with what you speak of, and I can't wait to hear about your experience on dealing with that. But you said at the end, modalities. What I realized as I was going through that process, that practice of being there for 10 days, the only other real practice in my life that I have experienced, I'm not a very religious person. There's really not any religion in my life. And I came across Stoicism 5-6 years ago, and I took a very strong liking to the practice of Stoicism and what it stood for. And what I found was that there was so much commonality to Vipassana and Stoicism. And I am sure, just the way you described the chakras and what you're going to look deep into, there's commonalities and threads to words you use there as well. The beauty of all this, there's no guru today that is going to preach to us, tell to us, etc., something that hasn't existed for, in the case of Vipassana, 2,500 years when the Buddha brought forth the practice. Stoicism, which is 2,000 plus years old at this point, and by Seneca and Epictetus and Marcus Aurelius, a great Roman emperor, to the chakras. That didn't just get started last week. These things are all practices that have been going on for a very long time, whether it was our pandemic a couple of years ago or the Antonomian plague, whether it was a financial crisis in 2008 or the Great Depression in 27, I think it was. My history teacher is probably crawling right now. Yeah. The bottom line is these things have existed for years. And if you're willing and interested to educate yourself and do what you're talking about doing, Jack, of really diving in and learning, then the tools are all there. But don't just learn it at an intellectual level. You could read all you want. I promise you, what you need to do is live it. You need to live it experientially to ultimately get to the root of what you're doing. And I love that you're going to do that, because it's one thing to talk about it. It's the other thing to go and do it. And it's 100%. Awesome.
100%. That's a beautiful thing to end. And unfortunately, because I have so many more questions for you, maybe we'll have part two, only because we've arrived at the top of the hour and I've got a bit of a hard stop. But I would love to peel this onion back with you, because you're spot on. Learning things like this is one thing, and it's good. You have to start with learning. You have to get exposure to different things in order for you to say, hey, you know what? This is aligned with me. This is something that I definitely want to integrate into my life and try. But then you're right. You've got to execute. You've got to put yourself in that moment so that you can experience it without it just being an intellectual exercise. So I agree with you wholeheartedly. In closing, Mr. X, and again, I hate to end this so quickly with you. What would you tell somebody who, A, is fascinated by your story and is reflecting on their own lives and they're saying, gosh, my life is chaotic. Well, maybe there's two camps of people. So there's somebody that, you know, I'm on a journey where I feel a little bit disconnected to myself, to my loved ones, to my work. I don't know my purpose. On the other hand, you have somebody like you who's driven and challenged and wants to push the envelope. In either scenario, what would you tell them if there's some interest in this? Learn about it, prepare for it, and actually do it. In your words, what would you say? Go.
Yeah, I knew that you'd probably end with a question like that. And I'm not sure I have any kind of really profound statement here. But I think you kind of hit it on the head there. If we are interested as human beings of being better people, more peaceful people, goodwill, love, compassion, all those things, then take action. And the action starts with finding one of these things like we've just gotten done speaking about. And then go knee deep into it and really learn about it and see if it resonates with you. Don't do it in a world of blind faith or devotion. Don't do it where just somebody told you to, or because you were born into it. Do it because you heard it, but do it because you really go to the depth and really want to learn it. And then to the point you made of experiencing it. I think anyone that doesn't feel like they're on a path today, things like Vipassana will help you. I do believe in the universal law of nature, and Dhamma, as it's called in that speak. I do believe that, cliche layman terms, what comes around goes around. And it doesn't always come around in a positive way for you if you're doing the right thing all the time. It's just the way life is. But you will find throughout life your ups and downs, and you'll find that you're on the path and you're off the path at times. But there's always a chance, just like Nietzsche and rising and passing, that things are going to come back to center. The question is, do you have control to help pull it back to center in a more expeditious way? That's really what it comes down to. Or do you allow it all to happen to you? So we all have access to libraries. We don't have to buy books. We can go in there and look some of these up that we've even talked about today and learn more and see if something catches on with you. And if it does, look, you didn't ask me the question. I'll tell you it right now. And it was one of the biggest reasons why I wanted to do this when I found out about it. It was, drum roll, please, you ready? Free of charge. This yep. wasn't a $5,000 retreat. This wasn't a $3,000. I had a couple of friends that I told about before I did this. They said, well, how much are you paying for that one? And I said, you're not going to believe it. Zero. These things exist because people have pulled them forward and said, you don't have to pay exorbitant amounts of money just to learn to grow, to be a better human being.
Right. So that objection is off the table.
Off the table. If you don't have money, you can go back there and donate your time for a weekend and serve food. Mm-hmm. Off the table. It wasn't a hard push at the end. So the things are available to us. We have the ability to do those things, but you have to take the step and put it in action.
You just completely eliminated the monetary piece of it, right? And then what comes next? Well, I could never leave my work, or I could never leave my family, or what would people think of me? You know, all these thoughts, but those have to really be eliminated in order for you to take that step forward.
Correct. Agreed.
Yeah. Mr. X, profound, man. Gold here today. I appreciate you coming on the show here today. I respect you and I respect your time. Certainly a powerful experience. And I have so many more questions, but we could discuss that another time. To the people that are listening, if this episode resonated with you, please, please, please share it with someone who might need to hear this right now. You never know what somebody's going through in their lives, and this may be an avenue that they may want to explore. You can find Mindset Reinvented on all major podcast platforms. Your reviews will help others discover these conversations. So for more episodes about personal transformation and awesome conversations like here today with Mr. X, follow us wherever you get your podcasts. And for now, I'm Jack Trauma, reminding you that sometimes the most profound discoveries happen in silence. Bye for now.
If you enjoy the show, subscribe so that you never miss an episode.